John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. In today's episode, we have what is maybe a much anticipated episode for a lot of my listeners. Those of you that have been listening for a long time, you know, a while back we were covering the Delphi case. There was some kind of miscommunication. I think we figured out was some miscommunication between us and my guest today about trying to have them come on and kind of talk from the more guilty point of view in that case. And the case that we're covering this week, we covered the murder of Scott Mecklem and potential or possible wrongful conviction of Temujin Kenzu when we had Aaron Habel on last week. Several people in our follow-up mentioned that the Murder Sheet podcast had done a lot of extensive work on this case and has done a lot of interviews. I was able to reach out with them, and actually our co-host on the follow-up, Janet, I think she's been chit-chatting with Kevin here and there, so she was able to make the connection. And I am joined today by Kevin and Anya. Guys, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having us, Bob. We're so thrilled to be here. Thank you.
And thanks to Janet. She's been terrific. I think I reached out to her because on our Friday shows, we're a little bit looser and sillier and
stupider.
And we do a lot of like quick hits on different cases from different states. And for some reason, I started making fun of state mottos. And I realized, oh my God, Janet Varney has a whole podcast about state mottos. Am
You're
I ripping
stealing
her off?
Thing.
Yeah,
right.
So I think at some point I said, I'm sorry.
Yeah. She's been sharing with me all of her communications with you guys over the past several months. So I'm glad we're able to make the connection. And this is a case that, you know, I mentioned when I had Aaron on in our follow-up and with you guys before we started recording. I'm not super familiar with this case. I certainly don't have a dog in the fight. I don't know innocent or guilty. I tend to look... Now, I know, Kevin, you're an attorney, right?
Yes.
And Anya, what is your profession outside of podcasting?
I am a journalist. I was a reporter at Business Insider for 6 years.
Okay.
To be clear, not a crime reporter, a retail reporter. My beat was Walmart and Costco. Yeah. But, you know, you kind of learn the fundamental skills. But that's my professional background.
And I was a fireman, so we're all very well in tune to do this.
Yes.
Now, but I tend to look at cases now from, you know, over the last 11 years. And now I have, you know, a criminology degree and a PI license. So I'm always looking at things from the perspective of an investigator. And particularly, most of the work that I do is defense investigation. So I'm always looking at like ground zero, separate the noise and look at like what facts actually can prove and show to me that there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt this person did it. And so I think it's a good mix with journalist, attorney, because, you know, and I think Kevin, I don't want to speak for you, but, you know, attorneys kind of do the same thing, but also an attorney's job is to turn that into a story to convince 12 people of what happened.
You're absolutely right. Now, I'll just throw in quickly, my father and my grandfather were firemen. Love firemen.
Yeah.
Great. Perfect. So we've got a good mix of people in the room, because when I say that I'm not familiar with the case, this is the craziest thing for somebody that hosts a true crime podcast. I don't like every big case that somebody's like, what do you think about this case? I have no fucking idea. I don't know. I don't listen. I produce too much to consume anything anymore.
Yeah.
So I never know what's going on. So, I mean, I had vaguely heard, you know, I'm from Michigan. So, you know, Temujin Kenzu's case is one that I've heard of quite a bit, but I've literally never looked into it before this last week, any of the facts of it. So I'm just starting to absorb the case material. And it does, I've taken away two things so far. And here, just a second, I'm going to kind of turn it over to you to kind of walk through the case from your perspective. When the little bit that I've read about it and having Aaron on and just talking to people, is that it seems like Temujin Kenzu is not a good dude. he's, I mean, by pretty much all accounts, a pretty bad guy. And also, I'm not convinced that he's an innocent man, but I'm not convinced of his guilt, aside from the fact that he's a tricky character for anybody to try to navigate, because if you're in the wrongful conviction space, and if you truly believe he's wrongfully convicted, well, now are we helping someone that we don't really think maybe should be walking the streets anyway? But with that being said, I'm going to have you guys kind of give your, because we've had Aaron do it, but from your guys' perspective, just kind of an overview of the case. And am I right in the fact that you guys are pretty well convinced that he is guilty?
Yeah, I would say we're pretty firmly convinced at this time. I will say, though, what you said, I think, is very apt about there being bad people, but that not really convicting somebody of a crime. I think we've taken some unpopular opinions on our show in the past. I think one that was quite unpopular, I can let Kevin speak about it because it's his hometown.
Yeah, there was a case in my hometown where there was a murder, and I the killer, obviously a bad guy. I think he pretty definitively did it, but he got an unfair trial.
Yeah, very unfair trial. There was police misconduct all over the place.
You don't just want to convict a guilty person.
No.
You want to play by the rules. And so I was in the position of saying, this guy is guilty. He's a bad guy. I'd feel better if he wasn't free, but we got to overturn this verdict. It's wrong.
Everyone hated that opinion. But I mean, right. Understandably, right? It kind of goes against our sense of justice. But to us, that is true justice. You know, your constitutional rights are sacrosanct. They should not be violated. So when we look at someone like Temujin Kenzu, we sort of think to ourselves, this is a very bad person. But there are reasons why we think he's guilty that have nothing to do with his character, or certainly are more about the facts of the case. And we also should say that we have people we respect who disagree with us, and that's okay. We think that there's healthy disagreement on all of that. What we like to do, though, is really, I guess, just start with the case file, look at everything. And we're talking about thousands of pages, Bob. This is like a nightmare to read. As you know, I'm sure you've been in the middle of this, like these trials transcripts, and you're like, this is so boring. It's hard to get through. The trial transcripts, the commutation hearing, it's all the police file, thousands of pages. And that's kind of how we worked through. And we also have talked to people in the case. We've talked to people who knew Kenzu, who were married to him, his daughter. We've talked to people who we can't talk about because they won't go on the record because they're terrified. Mm-hmm. So we've talked to a broad swath of people, too, because, I mean, sometimes the text on the page doesn't quite capture people's experiences as a whole. Yeah. But yeah, we can talk about some of the general things about the case that we think are important. I guess to start off with, the crime occurred on November 5th, 1986. Scott Macklem, young 20-year-old community college student at St. Clair Community College. He's showing up for class. It's around 9 a.m. and somebody shoots him dead in this community college parking lot with a shotgun. And a number of witnesses see some interesting things, but I don't believe anyone actually sees the killing. They're sort of coming upon the aftermath and what preceded it. Sure. And do you want to take it from there, Kevin?
Well, I'll step back a little bit and talk a little bit about Mr. Kenzu. I'm going to call him Temujin Kenzu. At different times in his life, he's used different names.
Right.
That gets confusing very quickly. Mm-hmm. So no matter what he was calling himself at the time, he now calls himself Temujin Kenzu.
And we want to respect what people call themselves. So we're like, yeah, he's Kenzu for us, but his name has changed.
This is a man with a long history of violent assaults on women in particular. I think women are his favorite category of victim because they are more vulnerable. I think that's important to mention, that when you look at the record, he raped and beat and did terrible things to many, many women. It's not just him versus one woman. Many women have said this. They tell very strikingly similar stories about what he did. And again, I'm talking about rape and assault. And I feel that has been minimized a lot. There was, for instance, he's married to a woman we called G. She's pregnant with his daughter. And to try to exert control over her, he orders her to impale herself on a sword. And she is so under his power, under his sway, she starts to do that. And this is just horrifying, this level of control he had over these women. and the threats he made against them. And so with that background, he meets this woman named Crystal. They go out on what Crystal believes is a date. He violently assaults her. He rapes her. And he begins pressuring her to continue seeing him. If you don't keep seeing me, I'm going to hurt your family. I'm going to do terrible things to you. During this time, she'd previously been involved with Mr. Macklem, Scott Macklem. They're broken up. They get back together later. But Kinzu sees him as a rival. And there's a couple of little confrontations that we can talk about if you want. Crystal ends up breaking up with Kinzu. She finds the strength to get away from him, which is not easy to do. She's one of the few women who were able to break away from him. And
who didn't just like flee and change their lives and disappear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Others escaped, but it was much more dramatic. She remained in this town with Scott, living her life.
Mr. Kinzu begins stalking Scott in particular, who he sees as a rival, breaks into his car, driving by his house at all hours. Scott lives with his parents. He notices this. At one point, he even tracks down these cars who are going in front of his house. And he follows them, and they're coming from a residence where we know Mr. Kinzu was. So he knows exactly who is behind this. There is another time he's out hunting with a friend, and he tells his friend, this guy who used to be involved with Crystal is harassing and threatening us. On another occasion, two guys come into the store where Mr. Macklem works and are acting kind of threatening. And I think on Aaron's show, he made it sound like those people were not identified. But actually, they were.
Because at least one of them was.
One of them was. One of them was identified as none other than Temujin Kinzu. So he was harassing him everywhere. So this goes on for months. Kinzu actually moves upstate. But these incidents continue. Then a few days before this murder, which Anya correctly said was, I think, on November 5th, there's a Halloween party. And Kinzu is at this Halloween party. And at this party, it is discussed, oh, guess what? Crystal is not only back together with Scott, but she's pregnant and they're getting married. And later in his commutation, at his commutation hearing, Mr. Kinzu says, that when he first got this news, he thought that there was a chance that the baby Crystal was carrying was his. That might be his baby.
Real quick, I just want so Kinzu was downstate on Halloween, so like 6 days before.
Yes,
the murder. Okay,
there are two witnesses that place him at that party. As with everything in this case, I should note that that's disputed. I believe Kinzu is witnesses of his own saying, no, he was up in Escanaba. So to be fair, like this dueling wit, and you've probably seen this, there's dueling witnesses everywhere you look. Okay. There are two people who are just like, yeah, I saw him. One woman talked about how she was there to see, I think her son's playing a band, and she saw Kinzu and she's like, oh yeah, like I recognize him. He's kind of got a specific look and he stood out in her mind.
And I think the key thing to remember is at his commutation hearing, Kinzu says, I knew she was pregnant. And so if he didn't go to this party, where would he have gotten this information about her being pregnant? And her being pregnant and him thinking that might be my child, that is very important. And I'll tell you why. Mr. Kinzu wrote what is frankly a very nutty and crazy 600-page religious book where he's creating a new religion and it involves talking mice.
It does. It's very odd.
And is part of this religion. He's the leader of their religion.
Yeah.
Obviously. And a big part of it is anyone who has his bloodline is very, very important and destined to be a huge leader in this movement. His daughter later tells us that when I visited him in prison, he said, because you have my blood, you are a princess.
You're going to inherit like all I have.
So when did he write the book? This is before all this happened or after?
No, afterwards.
He wrote the book in, I think, around 2010, 2015.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he was practicing these things.
I think the book is a kind of a product of, I mean, he's been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. I think there's like a level of self-aggrandizement that's been going on that we hear people who have interacted with him talk about was existing in the 80s. So I don't believe it's a situation where he goes to prison and loses it. I think this is kind of a natural kind of endpoint for ideas that had been maybe percolating for some time.
Yes.
Okay.
Hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
So now he's in a situation where my child, a future prince or princess, might be raised by another man. And we see the murder happening a few days later.
Yeah. And you might be wondering, well, you know, why are you talking about character evidence if you're talking about other women? The reason we bring that up, and I think that it's so important to talk about, is because Crystal makes for the star witness of the case in many respects. In some respects, it's often been portrayed as her word versus Kenzu. Who are you going to believe? And what we say is that we believe Crystal because other women went through the same exact thing that she did. They talk about the same things that he told them, that he told Crystal. I think I'm a person, as a journalist, I'm not somebody who necessarily likes the idea of just believing every accusation, right? I mean, there are wrongful accusations. There are wrongful claims of rape. We've seen people get convicted based on some of those wrongful convictions who were innocent and who were, I believe there was a famous case involving a football player once. It's very rare in my view, but it does happen. So you can't just take it for granted. What we look for is what corroborates this. And a lot of the things that Crystal said on the stand were wild, you know, talking about how he would claim he was part of a council of ninjas and that they would come kill her if she spoke out, or that he had listening devices that he was using to spy on her. It sounds wild. And we have talked to other women where they're like, oh, yeah, he told me that, too. I was living in fear. I thought they were watching the house. And so to me, I think it is important to note that that was part of an established pattern of behavior for him. And when you know that, I think it makes what Crystal says a lot more compelling.
Yeah. And I, from what I've read about it, and a lot of it is some source material that you guys have shared, I don't think there's any doubt. You know, that's kind of like when I opened up with, like, he's a bad dude. Like, I don't, like, I personally don't have any doubt that most of these accusations are true. Where I always try to get, you know, again, from like the investigator part of me is, what I get frustrated when I have like a legitimate wrongful conviction case that I'm investigating is I often find that the prosecutor did a great job proving that the defendant could have done it, would have done it, might have done it, probably did it, any of those things. But when you really dig into it, what evidence is there that they did do it? And it's not that those other things aren't important, right? That's all part of a circumstantial case. But, you know, I always end up coming back to, like, yeah, seems like the kind of guy that would do something like that. Seems like he's got motive to do something like that. But what is the evidence that he did do it?
Yes. And we think that that exists in a pretty compelling form in this case, in our view. Although I will say this is one of those cases that you read about it in mainstream press and you're going to come away with a specific impression. Because I'll frame it to you how it's been framed in mainstream.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. I'm not making a pun. But yeah. How it's been put together in mainstream press, and you're going to think, how the heck is this even possible? The way it's been traditionally put out there is that you have 9, 12, 20 witnesses placing Kenzu up in Escanaba, like over 400 miles away from Port Huron at the time of the murder. And that makes it an impossible murder, right? If you have that many people saying, you know, no, he's across the state. Can't be him, right? And that was my view going into this, where I was sort of like, well, how? I mean, Kevin was way ahead of me with all of the reading. And he was just like, I can't believe people are saying. And I'm like, well, I mean, like, that's pretty compelling. Like, how are you going to get around that? You know, how can you be guilty if that many people see you? And what we found reading the transcripts is that that's not true. That number is just made up. What I try to ask people when they bring it up to me, it's like, can you name those 9 people? If you can't, and you can't give me the time that they say they saw him, then you shouldn't be citing that number. In reality, there's a group of parking lot witnesses, and then there's about, I really say like one, but it's let's give it, be generous and say 3 people up in Escanaba. And that is what you have to determine who you find more credible. And that is what the case boils down to. Because on the parking lot side, the most important witness is a man named Rennie Gobine. He's a student, I believe, at the college. He's just walking in the parking lot. And he witnesses, at least I believe it is the aftermath of mm-hmm. what happened. And I believe he, Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's seeing a man drive away.
Yeah.
And so he's able to ultimately identify Kenzu, and he's very certain about it. I saw this man. This is despite the fact that throughout all these lineups, Kenzu is like shaving his mustache and, you know, like doing all these things to basically disguise himself. But he's very like, I saw that guy. I saw that guy. I saw that guy. Very certain.
Is he the one that, and again, yeah, I'm stumbling through this. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But is he the one who had like several different accounts or was it conflicting with you? Because there were some people that said they saw the person had a beard. Someone said they didn't have a beard. There was, you know, like the light, I think Aaron talked about on his show, the license plate numbers back and forth. So at least that made it seem. So I guess walk me through your side of it, because it made it seem, based on Aaron's reporting on it and a lot of it, which may be mainstream stuff that I'm reading, that it wasn't quite so, you know, so clear as far as the witness is like, oh, here's a lineup. Yes, that's him. That it was like the stories kind of kept changing and kept kind of warping and then eventually landed on him.
So Rennie was very solid. And I can talk to you about problems with Rennie in a moment. Problems that I don't think are a big deal, but others have made much about. For him, though, it was like, this is the guy. I saw this guy. I got a clear view of him and I'm certain it's this guy. Other people they were talking about, we saw a white male, tall, you know, relatively tall, dark hair, wearing kind of a drab military style jacket and a watch cap, dark watch cap on his head, pulled pretty low, like towards his brow, who's skulking around in the parking lot, looking around, doesn't seem to be carrying anything, but is kind of like going to a couple of things that when I've been in the parking lot, they almost seem like vantage points. There's a couple of different lots around here. So it would be a good place to stand, in my view, if you wanted to kind of, okay, like be looking for a certain car, in other words. So they're seeing this guy. None of them felt comfortable saying, it's definitely this guy. But they are describing someone who resembles Kenzu, and a similar military-style jacket is found in his car. And that is something that they all testify to. Nobody says, that's the man I saw, pointing to him at the stand. But they're saying that we saw someone consistent with what Rennie is describing. Rennie is the one who is certain it is this individual. The problem with Rennie is, and this might, I don't know, I think sometimes people get very eager to help in a case, right? Mm-hmm. And he gives a very detailed statement to police about what he saw. And then he says something to the effect of like, my next professor that I'm going into does hypnosis. Maybe he can help me find more details.
And the police say, no.
The police say, no, do not do that. Like, do not even think about doing that.
He does it.
And, you know, so people are often like, he was hypnotized, and they make it out almost that all of what he said is therefore null and void. But the fact of the matter is he gave his main statement prior to doing that. So tell him about how the law works in Michigan as far as that goes.
Well, at least at that time in Michigan, the rule was you can't go into court and give testimony based on things recovered in the hypnotic
process, which is good. That's a good law.
That's a good law because it's very easy to introduce false memories in that sort of situation. So when he testified, he was limited and he could only testify to what he said in his original statement.
But when we look at what he said the second time in the post-hypnosis, it really seemed like very similar to what he said originally. I think they're absolutely correct to have that be a standard there, but I don't think it erases what he initially says. And if we're saying the hypnosis is a problem, well, he got it in before that. So
what did the original statement say that indicated Kenzu?
Well, I mean, he's basically, I'd recognize the guy and described him, described what he was doing, described this kind of figure driving away from the scene very slowly. He's an ear witness to the shooting, but he didn't see Scott go down. And he then witnesses this guy kind of hunched over, kind of driving away from the scene through the parking lot, escaping in kind of an odd colored, I think, tannish gold car. Was that it?
Yes.
I mean, now you aptly pointed out witnesses, and we've all seen this in cases. They say different things. Like there are differences. To me, that's not a huge deal. I think it's the diversity of human memory. I think if I'm older than a person who I'm seeing, maybe I'll describe them as extremely young when they're, maybe I'm getting it wrong because my brain is just having some bias. Well,
people just aren't recording stuff. I mean,
yeah.
Eyewitness,
there's a reason they say eyewitness testimony is terrible evidence because,
you
it
know,
is.
It's, yeah. it's terrible, but it's also like there's enough commonalities between what all these people are saying that you're getting a picture of the kind of person who's in this parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's when, if it's only one person saying something, okay. If it's a couple of people and they're kind of, we're kind of getting this Venn diagram where it's all going together,
right.
I think that's more interesting to me at least.
So we have a situation, in other words, where Mr. Kenzu has been threatening Scott and making threats to Scott, threatening to do violence to Scott. Scott has no other danger points in his life. I think we're the only ones that talk to friends of Scott.
We went in depth.
No other risk factors. His risk factor is Temujin Kenzu. And a man meeting Temujin Kenzu's description is seen near the murder scene when Scott is killed.
And seen driving away immediately after the shooting.
I think that's a pretty good case. But then you have to deal with his alibi witnesses, which Anya says, oh, there's hundreds of people who saw him in Escanaba. Why don't you?
First of all, there's not 100 people. And this just drives me crazy. I wish people would just fact check, you know? I mean, just read the transcripts. You're not going to find 9 people, you know?
Nine is the number that I was, and the ones that I was focusing on was Manali and Dyer.
You nailed the important ones. Those are the ones.
Those are the key ones.
Those are the key ones.
And I'll tell you why those are the key ones. Escanaba is about a little over 6 hours away from Port Huron. So if the shooting is at 9 a.m., and you're seen in Escanaba at noon, then you couldn't have been in Port Huron at 9.
Yeah, because right. you're driving
there. Now, the shooting's at 9 a.m. and you're seen in Port Huron at 3:30.
In Escanaba.
And if you're seen in Escanaba at 3:30, you could have made the drive. You could have killed Scott at 9 a.m. and made it to Escanaba by 3:30. So the fact that someone sees you in Escanaba at 3:30 p.m., that's meaningless in terms of innocence or guilt. And the only people who talk about possibly seeing him during the time when he would have had to have been on the road are, as you say, Manali and Dyer.
And they're supported by an additional witness, Sherman. So I always kind of categorize them as three. But to me, it's not three separate things of them seeing him at different times and in different places. It's almost they're all bolstering each other. And I want to just be super clear about this. I don't think any of those people are lying at all. I don't think they're lying. I don't think they're trying to cover for him. I don't think they were threatened. I think they're trying to be helpful. Now, much like Rennie Gobian in a weird way. But with them, here's my problem with Dyer and Manali. So, I mean, I guess we should talk about all the alibi witnesses because you might be wondering, where does 9 come from? Well, I think it comes from Kenzu himself. And early on, when he's actually already in jail, he starts calling people in Escanaba on the phone, on the jail phone. And he calls his landlord. He calls a music shop that he frequents. Husband and wife own it. And he's telling these people, you saw me on the day of the murder. Remember at 11, at noon, at, you know, all these times where it would be very significant. And he gives this alibi to police, by the way, as well. He's like, okay, I woke up. I saw this guy. I saw that guy. I went into this store, saw this woman. So he's very detailed. And it sounds like a good alibi. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you're covered for the whole day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is these people didn't see him. And they're like, no, that was Thursday. We always meet on Thursday. There's no way we saw you Wednesday. And he just won't, like, and the reason we know all of this is because they testified to this for the prosecution at trial and were cross-examined and everything. But, you know, his landlord, for instance, I saw you that day. Don't you remember, Melvin? Melvin's like, no, I saw your girlfriend. Your girlfriend gave me these supplements, these vitamins you were going to give me.
Right, I remember reading about about that? Because he was the one that testified that was he testified to this, that Kenzu was trying to you know, he kind of characterized, or at least the way I read it was characterized as him trying to like jog his memory. But he's like, no, it was your girlfriend. Oh, I was waiting outside. No, I saw her leave alone while I went around the block, that type of thing.
Yes. And what I emphasize that these are people who testified is because you have to imagine the jury heard this. Mm-hmm. But you also have this pattern of him calling people and trying to basically push them into giving him an alibi. Mm-hmm. And you have this a number of times. People are saying no. You have him claiming to have gone into certain, I believe, a store at one point, and they were like, we didn't do any service of that kind that day. Like, we don't have any, like, that didn't happen. So first of all, now you're having sudden huge gaps in his whole day. And like, I mean, to me, it's not like, I always feel bad when someone has to kind of cobble together what they were doing like 5 years ago. Like, how would you even do that? I could understand making a mistake in that situation, but we're talking about weeks after the fact. I mean, if that, I mean, I think he's arrested on November 14th or something like that. Don't quote me on that exact date, but the murder happens on the 5th. And he's not only getting all this wrong, but then he's trying to basically like browbeat people into supporting him. Now, one of the people he calls up is Manali. And we know this again because a detective is in the jail when he's doing this, hears him talking. No, no, no. It was this day. No, you're wrong. It was this day. Remember? No, it was this day. You're, you know, doing the same thing he's always doing. Uh-huh. Then suddenly Manali, you know, is saying, well, I think maybe that was the same day I had this interaction with Kathleen Dyer. So let me call her. And he calls her and she testifies to this. It's almost this like, hey, do you remember this day? Oh, yeah, I remember that day. Oh, well, that's great because you're going to really help out Kenzu. And you almost get the sense that these are people who are excited to be helping. Like, oh, yeah, okay, I'm glad we could clear that up for somebody. You know, I don't think it's ill-intentioned, but they're tainting each other. And then the Sherman guy is able to, oh, well, yeah, I had a PTA meeting that day. And to me, when you see them testify on the stand, you can understand why the jury was like, absolutely not. They're asking Dyer, do you remember anything else about that day? No. Like, the fact it was election day? Oh, no, I didn't really remember that.
And in fact, one of the jurors gave an interview to a reporter after the trial. You know, you often see this because they say, oh, what convinced you? And the juror specifically says, you know, Kenzie was making all these calls. The alibi was too perfect. So the juror is saying, I didn't buy it. I think he was tampering and manipulating these witnesses. So I don't trust what those witnesses have to say.
They threw them out basically because of that. Mm-hmm. And I think they were right too, because I just don't think there was a lot of specificity to anything that they were saying. I mean, I know people say, well, Sherman supported it, but I think basically it was like a game of telephone where it's like, when you kind of get in the mindset of like, oh, don't you remember that day? It's almost like, oh yeah, I do. Like you're agreeable. Like, oh, it almost taints it from the beginning.
John Daly here.
You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino.
Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is the part of it that I was kind of looking into the most, because I'm always trying to like get past all the noise, get past the motive, get past the would you, could you, and get to the did you. And so this obviously noon alibi is the biggest, you know, if he was there, he can't be there. And I think one way to frame it is that it's this game of telephone and they're all kind of convincing each other. But also at the same time, what I'm seeing when you're, because, you know, yeah, it's not 5 years ago, but even, you know, a week ago, if I'm trying to figure out what I did on a certain day in 2026, when I have cell phones and all these other ways to track, this is 1986. It's not always that easy a couple weeks later. And I don't know. And maybe you can tell me when Manali and Sherman and Dyer were all kind of come up with his alibis. I believe it was a little while later, right?
Do you remember?
I'm thinking he's arrested in November. I think the trial was like maybe March or April. So it was probably February.
Yeah. So it's a while back before that.
Which is also bad because the longer it goes on, the worse,
right,
the witness is.
So what I'm always looking for when I'm investigating a case is when it comes to any kind of like witness testimony like that. You know, if anybody's listened to me for years and years, I always say, like, when, if somebody tells me a date and a time, I completely ignore it unless I find an anchor there somewhere. You know, like if you tell me, oh, it was 10 o'clock that night when I was like, well, you don't know that. But if you're like, oh, I remember because I just started watching Golden Girls when it came on, right? So there's some kind of anchor. So it kind of read to me almost because it seems like, you know, Manali was originally unsure of the date. He calls Dyer. They start talking, and I think it at least is worth noting that it could also be said that not so much a game of telephone, but they're finding their anchors by, because the way I understood it was that, you know, she's like, yes, I do remember seeing him there too, but I don't know what day it was. And he's like, well, I think it might have been this day or this day. And or she's saying, I think it could have been Monday though. And then he says, wait, no, you weren't in class on Monday. So then it had to have been Wednesday, where they kind of like by process of elimination, then land on the 5th. It just seemed like to me like a natural way I would expect people to try to figure out when something happened.
To me, it seems like they're working themselves up into something, you know, and to me, it's like if it wasn't something that you remember, I think the power of suggestion can be very powerful. And like to me, if Kathleen Dyer came up and said, I remember it was election day, I spilled coffee all over myself and then checked the time and it was one. And then I saw that to me is compelling. But when it's people relying on each other to get through putting together an alibi for a guy, that's extremely weak.
But was the alibi they were like at a class with him?
They were at the end of a class and then he had some conversation with Dyer about how nurses were overweight. Something like that. And then what angered them, I believe, ultimately was Sherman, a third man who did not see Kenzu, but was saying, well, I think the day I saw you was the day I had a PT. So that makes it to me, if like it's all an internal anchor within oneself, that's compelling because you're testifying to that. When it's like two people don't remember, but then they bring in a third guy, to me, it starts to smell of, I don't know, like people who are trying to be overly helpful, who are maybe convincing themselves of something that they don't truly remember.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, if you come down thinking, well, he's a bad guy, I don't think I would have voted to convict.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think that's a totally reasonable position. One problem I've had with how this case is presented in the media is they whitewash who this man is.
But also, I want to say, it also, when you read about the case in the media and you see the jury's decision, you're like, what were they on? How could they? And when you actually look at what was presented at trial, I think you at least, even if you disagree, you can understand it. And that's the key difference. I think it's important.
For sure. And like you guys, I've read so many trial transcripts and seen so many jury decisions. Like the jury's decision doesn't surprise me at all. At all in this. I'm certainly not in a position where I'm like, well, those, you know, as far as I'm concerned, those alibi witnesses are a lock. But for me, I can't dismiss that. I can't just, you know, it feels like very much trying to, because I'm looking for this conclusion, I'm going to, if it was me doing it, right? So yeah. I'm going to try to find ways to dismiss these, where if I'm looking at it really honestly from my own perspective, it's like, I struggle with that. I struggle with it because I don't have... I think it's that same kind of Venn diagram thing for me, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, you know, these three witnesses are all kind of like figuring out parts of their day and seeing how they fit together. And they're like, well, the only place this works. And, you know, there was the, you know, the judge in 2010 that it said, you know, they just like you guys said, nobody's lying here, right?
Yeah, that judge got so much wrong, though. I mean, is that Hood?
Yeah, Hood.
That was a mess. I mean,
at the end of the day, we're all entitled to our own opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Brett from the prosecutors, I think he comes down saying, there's not enough there to convince me. He's a bad guy. There's not enough there to convince me. Where I come down on is, again, when I see who he is minimized, when I see people act like he's this noble Zen master, when I see things misrepresented.
There's a lot of stuff where it's like I was a bad dude who made mistakes. What does that mean, sir?
I think when I was listening to Aaron's show, there's a bit where he says, well, Crystal's sister told the police that Kenzu should be a suspect. She didn't like him because he wore dark clothes. And that's just simply not true. She didn't like him because Crystal would come home and she would see bruises on Crystal's neck from where Kinzu strangled her. So if you want to argue he's a bad guy, I don't think he did this particular crime. That's an honorable position to take, and I have no issue with you.
No.
But just be honest about who this man is. And I want to talk about this case because I think people do have bad information about it. Bad information leads to bad conclusions. At the end of the day, I don't care what people think as long as they have good information.
I think for me, though, I do want to mention, you mentioned Crystal. That's another, for me, a case can be a case where there's some bombshell piece of evidence that seals it all up for you. DNA is a great example, right? Mm-hmm. This woman was strangled, raped, and murdered. We have the killer's DNA and semen in her body, and she didn't know him, so there's no reason for that to be there. Okay, slam dunk. There are other cases that I view as highly circumstantial. And for those, for me, and I think I may have a different philosophy from you, because I think for me, that's more about pebbles weighing up to the size of a boulder in terms of weight of evidence. And it's like all you'd have to knock all these things down. But if you pile them up in the right way, that to me is a conviction. And I think that happened here to Kinzu. I don't think there's one single strike against him that's necessarily doing it all. But I think what the jury heard was like, we can't discount all of this and it all adds up to murder. And one of those things is I believe, the parking lot witnesses. Mm-hmm. The other thing is Crystal. And we talk about, you know, sometimes I've heard it said, well, this shouldn't have come into the trial because it makes him look bad and it's prejudicial. But it actually goes to motive. And what we've heard from people who are, you know, smart criminal lawyers in Michigan nowadays is that nowadays more stuff might have come in because we understand intimate partner violence better now. Back
yeah.
then, you know, like maybe more would have come in today than in 1986. They were quite discerning. Let me give you an example. One of Kenzu's hostages, whatever you want to call it, girlfriend, I don't know, like someone he was manipulating and exploiting and beating and raping, was a woman who we called D. When she talked to the police, she said, yeah, he said he would kill me basically if I didn't give him an alibi for 700 miles away from the crime scene. That's not Escanaba. That's not 700 miles away. So he wants right. to be somewhere else with her at the time. That didn't come into trial. What he did to other women did not come into trial. All that came into trial was Crystal's experience with him. Because mm-hmm. ultimately that went to the dispute was he felt that Scott stole his woman. He views women as property and he killed over it. So when I see Crystal's testimony, that's something that I think has been very badly reported on for many years. I mean, I'm not singling anyone out. I just think it is. And that's something that has been, I found very compelling because I went into it being like, wow, she's saying all these crazy things. When you read it, you understand like this woman went through a nightmare that she was not expecting and she tried to survive it. And I feel horrible for her. She lost the father of her child as a result of this whole thing.
I'm sure, Bob, when you work on some of these cases, you're going out and you're meeting people and getting to know them and you care about them. And as I say, I think we're the only ones that have met the victims in this case and we care about them. And we know how much it hurts them when what they've been through is misrepresented or minimized. There are people out there now saying, oh, Crystal's a horrible person, and I'm basing this on what I heard on this podcast. And that just horrifies me. It's so wrong. And I feel an emotional connection to some of these people. I just want the true facts to come out. And I know I'm repeating myself, but wherever a person comes down to on innocence or guilt is fine with me as long as we're all operating from shared facts and a shared reality.
Yeah. And I also have heard from people, they're like, you know what, it's just too ambiguous for me. I think that's fine. We're not here to be the case police and say everyone must be in lockstep on guilt.
Right.
We're here to say we're convinced of guilt. It hits that standard for us. You know, we're firmly convinced. But, you know, other people have different levels, right? And that's okay. It keeps things interesting. You know, if we all agree on everything, yeah. things get boring fast.
Well, and I like that idea of the ambiguity in it because this is one of those cases for me, from as much as I've looked into it, where I can see where the ambiguity comes in because there isn't that smoking gun, right? And I have read those trials where you're like, Jesus Christ, what were these jurors thinking? Like this is like there was clearly this person's evidence. This doesn't seem like that. Like, I think the alibi witnesses are compelling, but there's problems with it. I think the parking lot witnesses are also compelling. And, you know, there's some issues. Like, neither one of them are rock solid, for my view. So I can see why people, you know, have, and I certainly don't have a strong opinion about it. You know, my opinion on the case as of right now is, and I'm very honestly, you know, I look at who Kenzu is, and I'm like, well, I don't really give a shit, though, that he's, that he's in prison. You know what I mean? But then I have to fight against that, too, because, you know, my position has always been that we're fighting for a better and fairer criminal justice system. And so, you know, it gets very complicated. And I know there's a lot more to this case, but we're going to do something a little different because Anya and Kevin have agreed to come on next week when we do our follow-up for this episode. So unless there's anything real particular you want to hit on right now, I'd like to continue the conversation along with Janet. Zach may be with us too. I'm not sure what his schedule is going to be like, where we can kind of continue the conversation, take some listener questions. We'll be doing it live on YouTube on Monday. I think we landed on at 8 p.m. Eastern for anybody that wants to join us. So this is airing Sunday, so it'll be tomorrow when this comes out. And I think we should continue the conversation there. Unless there are any other like real big points that you guys want to hit about the case right now.
I want to hit one thing. One thing that drives me nuts is that many people have said that because Kenzu had a real interest in martial arts and martial arts weaponry, he was anti-gun. That's not true. I just want to put a bug in everyone's ear. We have like people have nothing to do with this case talking about seeing him with firearms. And we also have Crystal's testimony putting a shotgun in his possession, you know, at least in the months before the murder. So that's something, because I think that's been out there for a while. This man was not allergic to guns. That's all I'm saying.
And I'll just say very quickly, one thing that Janet and I were chatting about in our emails is that often in the true crime space, there's an attitude that if someone disagrees with me about the innocence or guilt of someone, then that person must be my enemy, or maybe they've been paid off by somebody. And that's not true. All of us can disagree, and that's okay. That's part of life. As we mentioned, like Brett from the prosecutors, he disagrees with us. He came on the show. We had a discussion about it. It's fine.
Julia from the consul came on too. And we, again, it makes it more interesting.
It sounds like you might be in a more ambiguous place too.
Yeah.
That's fine. As long as we're all coming to our conclusions based on accurate information, that's all anybody can ask or hope for.
I just want to say, Kenzu has accused us, full disclosure, of being bribed by whatever entity is conspiring to keep him behind bars. I want to dispute that. We've not been bribed. We're not part of Big Michigan or whatever conspiracy he thinks is doing this now. Yeah. We did reach out to him for comment early on, but we did disclose to him that we do believe he's guilty. We were trying to be very polite and transparent, but I think he got pretty mad about it. So, yeah. You know, just everyone... We've tried to get both sides of it, but there's a limit to what we will get from his side of it because of that.
And those accusations, I mean, I do wrongful conviction work. So every case, you know, and I've done like a lot of work on like the West Memphis 3. So that, you know, you know, exactly what you said, both of you, you know, there's, I don't want to get into it, but I bet, you know, Brett a couple times, obviously I had, it's the only time in my, I can say in 11 years of doing this show, and I've done, you know, I had a whole other show just helping promote other, including their podcast. I've never really had a public disagreement with anyone, but it, just so you guys know, and I think my audience knows this, but that disagreement was because of exactly what you said, Kevin, where my issue was not that they had a different opinion than me. People always have different opinions than me. My issue was that we weren't working on the same set of facts. You know, that was my frustration with that. So I just want to put that out there because I agree 100% with what you said, that we can all disagree. We should all be able to disagree and get along. And I think that's great. And I think, you know, you guys coming out, because I know speaking of which, we disagree about the Delphi case. Mm-hmm. And before we went on the air, we talked about, you know, there was, you know, we had talked about having you guys on back when I was talking about that case. And I think here in the coming weeks, we're going to have Anya and Kevin from Murder Sheet here back on. And we will finally have that conversation where we can just have a good open dialogue back and forth about what my feelings are and why, and you guys can do the same, and we can, because I have not been able to really have anybody on that can talk from the perspective of, I think, that Richard Allen is guilty, and you guys have done a lot of work on the case. You've written a book on the case. So we've got all that coming. Make sure if you want to continue this conversation, it'll be tomorrow night on Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern time on our YouTube channel, the Truth and Justice YouTube channel. We'll have the whole gang here. It'll be a follow-up, so no holds barred. Who the hell knows what we're going to talk about.
Love it.
So we will do that. And Anya, Kevin, it's been great meeting you guys, and thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @TruthJusticePod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.